From the first day of the occupation on August 11th, we stood with faith leaders, union leaders.
From Interfaith Alliance, this is The State of Belief. I'm Interfaith Alliance President Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch in New York City.
We stood together as a DC United. And I think that that is really, really critical for our movement, that we stand together in that way.
Home rule has always been a sore spot for Washington, D.C. leaders and residents. But that's nothing compared to the unprecedented federal takeover we've seen in the past 4 weeks, based on trumped-up claims of crime out of control that ignore the significant decreases in recent years, as well as far worse numbers in red states like Louisiana. This week, we'll get into all of that with Kaya Chatterjee, co-founder and executive director of the grassroots organization Free DC. We need these voices to be heard now more than ever. Make sure you subscribe, share, and rate The State of Belief at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Taking a minute to do these things really helps other people discover our show and become listeners too. Our library of past conversations includes almost 150 hopeful, empowering, and inspiring interviews with guests like Bishop William Barber, Imam Abdullah Tepli, Representative Eric Swalwell, Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum, and many others. You can help grow The State of Belief with a financial contribution right now. Find out how at stateofbelief.com, and you can support and join the work of Interfaith Alliance at interfaithalliance.org. Before we get to my interview with Kaya Chatterjee, I wanted to introduce another voice to you. His name is Reverend Andrew Andy Oliver, pastor of Allendale United Methodist Church in St. Petersburg, Florida. He and another pastor were praying at a Black History Matters mural at the Woodson African American Museum. The mural, like so many others, was about to be destroyed. Here's Andy to talk about what happened and why it matters so much that he showed up.
I was sitting at home and saw a picture posted on Facebook of the Florida Department of Transportation preparing to erase a mural outside our city's African American History Museum, the Carter G. Woodson Museum. And I felt compelled to reach out to a few people to make sure it was okay. And I called another pastor, and we went out there, and we knelt on the mural, and we prayed.
All across Florida, there are symbols of diversity and the richness of community that are being painted over, erased. This is part of a broader campaign.
Yeah, our governor, Ron DeSantis, decided that rainbows and murals toward Black Lives Matter or just about justice in general needed to be erased. And to do so, he said, well, I'll just erase all the murals. So even the ones that are just art are getting erased all over the state. It's been part of an ongoing systemic cruelty that our governor has been doing all across the state.
It's very connected in my mind to the censorship of books. I mean, it's like whose stories matter, whose lives matter, who matters. You said you were compelled. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's a very strong word. And I want to linger there for a second, because I think that's where a lot of us are. What will it take? And how will we get up and show up in moments that matter?
Yeah, I'm a pastor who's a white, straight, cisgender male. I have the most privilege of most people that I come in contact with. And I felt compelled to use my privilege in that moment to be in solidarity with those in our state and in my local community who are feeling erased. When murals are erased that represent inclusion and equity, it feels personal, right? Because it is personal. You know, while our governor is erasing a mural on a street outside African American History Museum, he's also erasing the ways that African American history is taught in our state and teaching it in some pretty incorrect ways, harmful ways. And so this isn't just about murals, right? This is about, again, a system of harm. I've had trans people in my congregation erased, needing to flee the state in order to provide health care for their children or for them themselves as adults. This is increasingly not a safe state for people to live in. And so as someone who has a lot of privilege, my faith compels me to put my very body on the line. Sure, there might be consequences, but, you know, my grandmother taught me there's some things worse than facing consequences. And in this moment, it would have been not doing anything.
You have spoken compellingly about how you understand the relationship between the law and faith and what it means to be a religious leader today. Can you talk a little bit about that in the face of all that your congregation is experiencing right now?
Yeah, first of all, the vows taken at my baptism and the vows I took at ordination compel me to resist evil, injustice, and oppression in whatever forms they present themselves. And so that means sometimes to resist the law. You know, history teaches us, the very history of that Black History Matters mural, it teaches us that to obey the law is not always to be faithful, and then to be faithful is not always to be lawful. Dr. King taught us that, right, in his letter that he wrote to us from a Birmingham jail, that an unjust law is no law at all. And I've had people in my life that have invested in me throughout my ministry that have taught me that when injustice is happening and I have the ability, I need to put my body in the way.
This is a really important time for religious folks, especially religious leadership. It feels like a test. Where are we going to put our energies and our solidarity? And you've shown us a really important way forward. And I really applaud you and the other minister who did it. And hopefully we'll have a chance to hear more from you and your work in Florida in the future.
Absolutely. And I really want to reiterate that this is not a story about me. This is something much bigger. And I want to center in this moment the Carter G. Woodson Museum in St. Petersburg and encourage people to support it so that history can be told in even bolder ways that will inform how we live in the present and into the future.
And now to my guest. Kea Chatterjee is the co-founder and executive director of Free DC, a civic campaign defending Washington, D.C.'s home rule and protecting the civil liberties and democratic dignity of its residents. That sounds like something we need to hear about right now. Kea has an impressive background in social and climate justice, having previously led the U.S. Climate Action Network, worked at World Wildlife Federation, USAID, and NASA. Under her leadership, Free DC has become a prominent voice opposing federal overreach, a very big job indeed in the face of the Trump administration's forcing federal law enforcement on the district and expanding detention powers. Free DC is forging powerful alliances around this urgent cause, and I am very happy that the executive director, Kea Chatterjee, is with me today on The State of Belief. Kea, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Could you have imagined this a year ago? Was this something that you were in some ways predicting, or how has this hit you, and how has Free DC been preparing for this moment?
Yeah, unfortunately, we have been very aware that this was coming for a long time, and partly because we were listening to the stump speeches that Trump was giving on the campaign trail, and he was saying repeatedly that he wanted to take over DC, and we are very much students of authoritarianism and dictatorships, and you know, looked and saw like, oh, well, dictatorships, of course, they want to control dissent in the Capitol, because dissent is in the Capitol is what requires them to leave office when their time comes, for example. And we know that this particular regime already tried to use violence to not allow a transfer of power in the Capitol. And so we were very, very aware that this was coming. We launched in January, just before the inauguration, and have been training thousands of people since then in preparation for this moment and more, because it has been, you know, telegraphed what it was they're planning to do. You know, when they say things like, we're going to have Trump 2028 and you'll never have to vote again and third term, all these things are things that we took seriously from the beginning and have been preparing for.
Thank you for saying that. It really is one of those things. Just listen to what they're saying and believe them has been like really a theme.
Yeah.
Believe them. These are not rhetorical flourishes. These are actually what they're planning. That has been the same in the religion community. Like when he's talking to Christians, say, we will be your retribution. That is something that's signaling how you're going to approach religion in your second term. Believe them, and you believe them. And so how did Free DC start? You mentioned in January, but what was the genesis of Free DC?
Well, it emerged from work that we have three other co-founders of Free DC, and it emerged from work that they were leading on in 2023. So in 2023 was the first time that we had a law that was a DC law that was overturned by Congress. That doesn't happen in other cities. That doesn't happen in other states that Congress overturns their laws. And we have something called the Home Rule Act. We don't have statehood in DC because of a legacy of slavery. I think that's one important thing for people to understand. This is about a legacy of racism. The civil rights era and the incredible leaders we had during the civil rights movement, who were the originators of the Free DC movement, Marion Barry, Julius Hobson, so many others. These are figures that through the civil rights era fought for voting rights for the people of DC. And what they got was what we call limited home rule and the Home Rule Act of 1973 that went into effect in 1974. So in 2023, it was the first time Congress overturned a DC law. And unfortunately, lots of Democrats went along with it, and even President Biden signed it. And this was a full-on attack on democracy in DC, because they were overturning our laws that our legislators passed in a body, Congress, where we have no representation. So once that happened, Hands Off DC emerged, and that was a defensive campaign. In the run-up to this Trump 2.0 regime, we realized that we couldn't just have a defensive campaign that said hands off, that we actually needed to have a vision for the future, a vision for liberation, and a vision that completed that journey that the civil rights leaders of the 1960s began and brought us to equal representation for the people of DC, that brought us to liberation for the people of DC. And so we picked up the mantra and the campaign that was started by Mayor Marion Barry of a demand for a free DC. So it was very much anchored in the history of activism in DC, but also in the very, very recent history of having our democracy attacked, even by people who some might be surprised to find were attacking DC's democracy.
Yeah, this is so helpful to frame it that way and to take it all the way back. The legacy of DC is rooted in slavery and in racism, and that, you know, that has been part of the operating rationale for why DC has not had representation. And it just connects to me with the redistricting that's happening and the theft of representation happening in Texas. This is connected to a wider effort, again, to really try to dictate who matters, whose vote matters, whose representation matters in our broader democracy. And it's so helpful. Can you, at this point, just give us a sense of what's happening on the ground, because a lot of us are not in DC. All I know is what the clips that I see, but it just feels like, it just looks like everywhere you turn, there are these bands of people who have complete jurisdiction over the people of DC without their approval.
You know, just to give you a sense, I went on a 3-mile bike ride last weekend, and I passed a gang of what looked like DEA and HSI agents. I passed National Guard, who were armed with large, large semi-automatic weapons. I passed, ICE has new black SUVs with a logo on them that they drive in circles and it through neighborhoods to terrorize people. And they don't always use them, but they have them. And I passed a number of checkpoints where the Metropolitan Police Department, our local police department, was aiding and abetting an illegal checkpoint being held by federal agencies. And so that's just like in a 3-mile bike ride across DC. And I just happened to be going from point A to point B. I was not looking for law enforcement. And that is like the visual cues. I think what we see in the courts is really important as well. What we see is that they are arresting an enormous number of Black and brown men. Black men are mostly going into the DC court system. It's so jammed up that people are not getting out till 1-2 in the morning. Judges are saying they know that there's Fourth Amendment violations. They know there's constitutional violations, but there's nothing they feel like they can do about it. On a normal night, there might be maybe dozens of people. And now we're talking about over 100 people. And so they're just snatching people up and arresting them. You know, with immigrants, sometimes they're getting sent out of DC very quickly, and sometimes even further away very quickly. And so finding people is very hard. And so part of what we have been training people to do is understand how to observe this in a way that is most supportive to the person being attacked. And the people being attacked are a combination of, again, it's a lot of Black and brown men being attacked. So it's immigrants, it is returning citizens, it is our youth. So 14 to 18 year olds have been a particular target of this administration and this regime. And it is our houseless neighbors. So that is who is being targeted, is what we see. The other thing we see that I think is really important is the incredible defiance of the people of DC. And so we have seen people direct traffic away from checkpoints that are illegal. We have seen people literally chase ICE out of the Columbia Heights neighborhood. We have seen people stand with cameras and insist that the person being detained did nothing wrong until that person is actually released multiple times. And then we have seen so many volunteers getting the name and information of the person being illegally detained so that their family can be alerted and we can actually get them out. And then, of course, on top of that, we have the very famous like sandwich thrower who was not indicted by a grand jury in DC. And so we're seeing that people in DC really understand what is going on here in this occupation and are not willing to go along with it.
That is a very helpful and hopeful reminder. And it reminds me that, you know, there has been polling. The people of DC don't want this. Like, as much as they're saying, oh, we're trying to protect you, by that they mean, like, you know, the white people. I mean, that's what they literally said. Stephen Miller was saying that, you know. But something like 89% of people resent it. They don't want it. They aren't asking for it. Even more than that, the fact that people are standing up. And I love what you said about we've been training people, we've been organizing people. And I think not everybody who stands up necessarily has been organized, but many people are interested in being a helpful part of the resistance right now to this. And I just think it's a lesson as we go forward, because this is the precursor to more occupations like this. And so can you talk a little bit about what it means for that population to be prepared and to be ready, as opposed to just doing things that will like harm the people they're trying to protect or put themselves in danger, instead really approaching this from an intentional way, like the people from the civil rights movement did, getting trained up?
Yeah. I mean, 700,000 people live in DC, and none of them ask for this, and all of them see how dangerous it is. And in DC, we understood what was happening, I think, before people in the rest of the country understood, because we lived through the first few days of the DOJ mass firings, which were so illegal. And we saw these people breaking into federal buildings. We saw them actually steal a $500 million privately owned building at the U.S. Institute of Peace, which now a judge has returned to the U.S. Institute of Peace. But it was so brazen the early days. And so people in DC were really understanding that we had moved into a dictatorship and had lost democracy much, much, you know, earlier than even people who were paying attention in the rest of the country. So when we put on trainings from the beginning, they have been standing room only. You know, from the very beginning, we have had a full house every time we've put on a training, and people have been ready because they, you know, because people saw what was coming. You know, like if you, you know, DC became more dangerous when this administration started mass firings. DC became more dangerous as soon as, you know, they started kidnapping immigrants, which they're doing all over the country, kidnapping our neighbors. DC becomes more dangerous when this terrible bill goes in place and we lose Medicaid, lose school funding, lose SNAP funding. That's food, right? And of course, DC became much more dangerous when we had these, you know, like very unqualified people being named as our prosecutor. That's another indignity we suffer in DC, which is that our the person who prosecutes our local laws is actually not selected by us. That is different from everywhere else in the country. And so people in DC were really primed and ready to be trained up. The other thing is that like we had experience, right? Because our communities, our neighborhoods are places where our culture even of like go-go bands and you know, making fun of anyone who doesn't like mumbo sauce. Like this is something that has been under attack by Trump in the first administration. They sent the National Guard in the first administration when there were uprisings about George Floyd's murder. And so we knew that our communities would be under attack. Our public schools would be under attack, that kids were going to be, you know, exposed to violence, you know, from the state. And so again, I think that we had conditions that are now emerging in other parts of the country where people were really, really ready to come and get trained and understand what is it that actually gets us out from under this. And the answer is very clear, right? The answer is that it's collective action. It's leaning into our power, not only as voters, which we have never had in DC. We've always been told if you want to have power as a voter, take a bus to Pennsylvania or Virginia and talk to those voters. But it's not the power as voters that is the most powerful right now, because their entire electoral strategy is backed up by a threat of violence. The most powerful parts of our community right now is our power as jurors, right? We're seeing people not give these indictments. Our power as consumers, our power as workers, which we can refuse to do. They certainly don't know how to run schools or deliver food or cook. Our power as taxpayers, that collective power is ultimately what takes down every dictator in the world. And what we know from history is that dictatorships do fall.
Up next, much more with Kaya Chatterjee. You can hear full episodes of The State of Belief anytime on our website at stateofbelief.com. You'll also find links to topics we discussed this week, as well as transcripts and more. And make sure you subscribe, share, and rate The State of Belief at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. You're listening to The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Welcome back to The State of Belief. I'm Interfaith Alliance President Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. My guest is Free DC Executive Director Kaya Chatterjee. Can we turn a little bit to the role of religion in this moment? Because, you know, one of the things I'm talking about is just like, you know, religion can be the handmaiden of the worst of our angels. The religion can support dictators and does around the world and has in our country. The amount of religious groups that supported, were anti the civil rights movement, that supported slavery, the list goes on and on. Religion can be on either side. And the question is, where will we stand? Where will we show up? Where will we speak out right now? And that's the question, listeners, I'm asking each one of you. Think about that. Where will you show up? With whom will you show up? How will you show up? And I guess I would love to hear a little bit about your reflection about how religious communities have been a part of what is happening in D.C. and what you would like to see from faith leaders, as well as, you know, the broader religious, diverse religious communities that are in D.C.
Yeah, I mean, from the first day of the occupation on August 11th, we stood with faith leaders, union leaders, people who work with the unhoused population, people who work with the immigrant population, Black DC Native. We stood together as a DC United. And I think that that is really, really critical for our movement, that we stand together in that way. You know, we all live in places, right? And in a place, nobody wants their neighbor kidnapped. Nobody wants their community, you know, attacked. Nobody wants to see civil liberties, you know, gone. And so the more we can stand together in these places against this brutality, the more likely it is we will prevail. And, you know, if you go back to the U.S. civil rights era, where we brought down the authoritarianism of, you know, it was a racial authoritarian regime, Jim Crow, and it was brought down by a coalition of grassroots activists, faith leaders, union leaders, and a broad swath of society, right? And that is what we need to do right now, is to come together as in as broad of a swath of society as we can, and to say not only yes what we do not want, which is this brutality, we do not want this brutality, but also say what we do want. We want a functioning democracy. We want liberation. We want, you know, equal representation under the law for everybody. And I think it's really important that we do both things, right? And we see a lot from the faith community, an incredible willingness to help people who are harmed. And then I think that the other thing we are seeing is that the second important piece of this, which is a willingness to not comply with harm, right? A willingness to not comply with a tyrant, a willingness to not comply with white supremacists who wish us harm. And I want to be really clear, like, that's who Stephen Miller is. Stephen Miller is the person in charge of the DC implementation. This is a white supremacist who has explicitly wished us harm. And so we have to stand together not only in reducing harm, but also in refusing to comply with any regimes that are enacting that harm.
Yeah. I mean, this is so important. The other thing, you know, that one a former guest on the show, Maria Stephan, said, like, it's a vision for the future. And if faith leaders can also, like, I think with King and with others, this idea of, like, there is a possibility of a different world, you know, and the different world on earth, not just in heaven, on earth. And that is the mandate of our faith traditions. That is, like, what we have to have that vision. And that can be an effective tool against authoritarians, who want you to think that there is no future aside from their rule. And I think that's so important. Do you have a personal faith tradition that you were brought up in, or any principles that informs your own work?
I would say that I was very nominally raised Hindu, in that for big holidays we would go celebrate them, and very much, you know, like, you know, was told a lot of stories from that tradition, you know, but it, you know, it, while I would say that, like, it's not a big part of my life or daily practice, it is a big part of my, you know, my like grounding and centering to use things that come from that tradition. Right. And so whether that's like pranayamic breathing or yoga, or like these things that really emerge from Hinduism and are a core part of Hinduism, are a part of my practice that allows me to find joy even in a place that's really difficult, that allows me to find calm even in times that are really turbulent, and are things that I tap into. And we know, you know, through the history of time that oppressed people have used, you know, song and dance and prayer and all the things that like bring us together as a community. And like, those are things we lean into very much at Free DC, in addition to like my own personal practice.
Yeah. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because I do like I love that you bring up song and that you bring up these kind of like, that it's not just like, okay, you know, march, march, march. It's also like joy. And it's like, and it's in real time, like embodying what we hope for and embodying what we long for. And And the role of music is so important there, as well as, you know, just showing joy in the face of like these this other way. And you can offer this visual and embodied alternative that is so attractive, you know, and invites people in. Say a little bit more about the intentionality of incorporating that into Free DC.
Yeah, I mean, it is the number two thing we tell people. So our five like bits of ethos we ask people is, you know, do not obey in advance. Like if you give away your First Amendment rights without them being taken away, you might as well not have them. Do not obey in advance. The second thing we tell people is prioritize joy, which is related to the third, which is take up space. And show solidarity, of course, with those, you know, recognizing that we are all under attack, and letting them divide us is not going to help. And then the fifth is organize, meet people where they are and bring them on a journey with you. And so the reason we put prioritize joy so early on is that it is very much what allows us to do the rest of the work. If we don't care for ourselves and recognize this is a long journey and we must care for each other and take care of each other, we won't be able to make this journey. And so all of our events have this nod to prioritizing joy, often through song. Because it also helps people realize, you know, if you're in a training or on the street or wherever you are, when even if you're a terrible singer, like I'm not a great singer, but that's not really the point. The point is that together we can create beauty. And together we can do amazing things. And it's amazing what it does to a room full of strangers when even you just do like a little bit of call and response song, people are suddenly like, oh, look at what we did, right? And it really changes, you know, your ability to do the work that we are called upon to do in this moment. You know, whether we like it or not, we are here in this moment. We are alive. We are presented with this situation of tyranny. We are presented with an amazing amount of harm around us. And we are called upon, I believe, therefore, to do something about it. And there's no way to do that if we aren't taking care of ourselves and if we aren't experiencing joy. It's just not possible, I don't believe. And so we think that it's one of the most important things that we can do is experience joy together. And, you know, to me, that's a little bit different from like from necessarily like self-care, which is important. But what it is it's community care.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, it sounds so inviting. And I am curious, like, how Free DC is communicating with other, especially cities, because other cities that are under threat right now. And I understand DC has a very particularity behind it, its own history, its own. But, you know, there are similarities in the sense of, you know, let's just say it, like democratic cities, one, often cities led by Black mayors. I am curious, like, are you in touch with people in Chicago, Baltimore, other cities that have come up on the list? Noticeably, of course, Speaker Johnson's city is not included on that list, ironically. Say a little bit about the way you're imagining DC can actually help other cities prepare for what might be coming.
Yeah, I mean, we are in touch with other cities. I have been in touch with folks in certainly LA, Chicago, Boston, New York, just to make sure that we want to share whatever we've learned. And of course, people in Baltimore are, you know, often are in our community and are coming to DC. They're very proximate to us. We think it's really, really important for us to be in solidarity with each other, and have been helping in any way we can. You know, the other hat I wear is with a group called Freedom Trainers, and we actually travel and do trainings of trainers, so that people in communities can learn the skills of what it takes to bring a democracy not back to where it was, but back to a better place, and what it will require of us, and what are the skills that we'll need. So yes, DC is quite different in many ways from these other cities in that both were smaller You know, it's 700,000 people. But also the stakes are very high, because if a dictator controls the capital, it's really, really hard to stop them if they silence dissent here. And also we're unique in that we lack critical power that all of these other communities have, in that they have the protection of, of having these rights that we don't have, right? We don't control the National Guard. We don't, the U.S. attorney that the regime picks charges people. We don't, we're not able to even control our local laws. They froze our $1.1 billion of our locally raised tax dollars earlier this year. And so we lack critical power. But I think that that has made us have to be more organized and more creative, and then we can share that learning with other cities. Not to say that the other cities also don't have amazing and creative organizers.
Course.
I should say, like, it's pretty, like our community in every place I have gone has been inspirational.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? I mean, and it doesn't have to be, you flying in and telling everybody what to do, but it can be this kind of a further expansion of the collective, what it means to be in this together. Can you, just help us, vision forward? Like, how are you, I hate to use the word gaming out or imagining the future in D.C.? What can you imagine happening, even as we approach next year's midterms and other, what are you preparing for? Do you see an end game or a next game, I guess, for all the organizing that Free DC and others are doing in DC?
I mean, of course, the future very much depends on our actions, right? We have a lot of agency. You know, we saw in December in South Korea that the President Yoon declared martial law, and 48 hours later, he was gone. He's been impeached because the labor union said, absolutely not. We're calling a general strike. And then he said, oh, that strike is illegal. And they said, no, you're illegal. The K-pop people came out. People poured into the streets. So we know that, what happens from here very much depends on our agency and how we behave collectively. At the same time, we also know how this plays out in other dictatorships where we don't get fast U-turns, if you will. And so we know that, there will be, their electoral strategy is and has been backed up by a threat of violence. So our electoral strategy must be backed up by a threat of nonviolent noncompliance. Like, we're not going to allow elections to be stolen is the way we win through elections, in the same way that, Milosevic in Serbia was taken down by election, the same way Pinochet was taken down by election. That requires a great deal of organizing apart from the election. So we fully anticipate that they will do what they say, and they will try not to allow a transfer of power, and they will try to ignore any restraint on their power. So far, they've been able to intimidate and bribe anyone who gets in their way in Congress. But if that does not hold, we know that they really, have broadcast that they plan to not leave at the end of their term. And so we have to, we have to be prepared for these kinds of things. As a community, we have to put an end to it. And so, that's why we're organizing under the banner of Free DC. That's why we need allies around the nation to help us. We have on our website, freedcproject.org/allies and freedcproject.org/occupation, where people in other states can help us. For example, there are many states that have sent their National Guard to DC right now. That doesn't happen to other states, right? Other states' National Guards are here. That puts them in danger because we're in the middle of a climate crisis too. And so Tennessee is still underwater. All these Gulf states that could have hurricanes, we're in the middle of hurricane season. Their guard is here instead. And so we know that whatever comes, we will have to be organized, and we will have to stand together as a nation, as a people who want to experience democracy and equality. The things they say are bad words: diversity, equity, inclusion. These are beautiful words, right? These are beautiful things that we stand for as a community. And we will need to stand together. I think the longer horizon of what I see in the future of DC is a free DC. That's why we call it Free DC. What I envision for DC is liberation. What I envision for DC is that the beautiful communities and neighborhoods that we have here are able to live and be themselves, right? Like I have a romance novel coming out in October that is about, you know, taking down authoritarians. But like in my vision of the future, people can do the fun thing they enjoy doing. For me, writing romance novels, they won't have to fight every day tooth and nail for every single one of their rights against a regime that is taking them away one by one. And so there's different time spans to the future.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I can't let this go by. What's the name of your romance novel and how could people get it? I didn't know this was a book promotion, but now I'm really down for it. So tell us everything. I'm sure we can do pre-order. What is the book?
You can pre-order it. It's called The Revolution Will Not Be Rated G.
Woo! Good title. I am there for it. Okay, let's go. This is good.
It's a romance between an activist and the son of a fascist that takes place. It's a happy ending, as all romances are. The genre is known for it. And so it ends with a general strike that succeeds. I can give that part away.
This sounds like everything that we all need right now, which is a little romance, a little activism, and a little hopeful future. So say the name one more time. And if you have a preferred place that people can order it, let me know.
Yeah, it's The Revolution Will Not Be Rated G. Of course, you can order it anywhere, but we are trying to take away the resources that power this regime. So please don't buy it in a place that gives money to Jeff Bezos. You can go to bookshop.org or any local shop and get it.
Go to your local bookstore and ask them to have it on the shelf. I think that sounds great. Let me ask you a last question that I'm really, doubling down on is, what does courage look like to you today?
It looks like community. That is where we are seeing courage come from. It's really scary to be by yourself right now, and that's exactly how they want us. And, you know, my colleague, Daniel, often says that, like, we earned this coup by not knowing our neighbors. And we will unearn it by knowing our neighbors. It is only in community that we will turn this around. And the places where I see courage are the places where people don't feel alone. So we have to come together right now.
Mm. Kaya Chatterjee is co-founder and executive director of Free DC, a civic campaign defending Washington, D.C.'s home rule and protecting civil liberties and democratic dignity of its residents. In addition to numerous leadership roles at national social and climate justice organizations, Kaya is the author of the book The Zero Footprint Baby and has a new book coming out, The Revolution Will Not Be Rated G.
Okay.
Thank you for all that you're doing and for all the inspiration that you've given us today, and also the tactical, clear ways that you've helped us understand this moment and all of our roles in it.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Who do you know who would get a lot out of this discussion? Please share the State of Belief with them and be sure to subscribe to the State of Belief at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. We need your help to continue growing the State of Belief. Please make a financial contribution today at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Religion News Service or Religion News Foundation. The State of Belief is produced by Ray Kirstein and is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week. I can't wait. I am talking with Sam Helmick, the president of the American Library Association. Until then, I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch at the State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet.